Hi, this is Andy Summers on Life Minute TV, talking to you. Watch the show.
Iconic guitarist Andy Summers continues to leave an indelible mark on the music world. With that distinctive guitar style and sound that helped define the sound of The Police more than 40 years ago. Since those days, he's released 14 studio albums, written several books, and is currently on tour, performing against a projected backdrop of photography that he's taken throughout the years, all while sharing readings and musings from his life and work with the crowd. The cracked lens and a missing string is making stops across the country through November. Andy stopped by the Life Minute studios recently to tell us all about it and more. This is a Life Minute with Andy Summers.
All right, Andy Summers in the house. Thank you for joining us.
I'm here. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be anywhere.
Well, we're so happy to have you here. So you're touring right now, a performance called The Crack Lens, A Missing String, which I saw was excellent. Tell us about, you know, for those that don't know, what it's all about.
Well, I mean, for several years, well, obviously all my life I've been a guitarist, and I took up photography, and it's become another obsession, passion, you know, which I spend serious time on. The odd thing is that I didn't combine these two things before. So this show is a combination of my music, my guitar playing, and, you know, photography, which we've worked out into a sort of, well, you know, a multimedia show, basically. I show various sequences of photography, and I play special music for the sequences, and that's sort of what it is. So you'd have to be into me and my thing to enjoy it. But there's solo guitar, guitars with backing tracks, very exotic photography from all over the world. And that's what it is. And, well, honestly, I think it's going really well. We generally get a standing ovation every single night. People seem to really like it because I think it's a bit different. And I don't think it's an entirely new concept, because if you go back to the 1920s when they first had silent movies and you had a guy on the organ playing below, we're still there, you know, but of course I've got all my incredible guitar technology and the beautiful screen. It's fun for me to do, and, you know, it's multimedia in the sense that we've got film, photography, music, and I talk and tell stories, so on and so forth.
Yeah, great storytelling, very interesting. And photography, that started for you while you were touring with The Police.
Yeah, I mean, it was a moment not very far from where we're sitting right now in New York City, and we were seemed to be hanging around New York City for some reason, and people were catching on to this band is going to be the biggest band in the world. And we were surrounded by photographers. They all seemed to be female. I don't know why. All the photographers were ladies, you know. And I started to look at the equipment. And I started to kind of, wait a minute, this is kind of interesting. I think I want to get into this. Yeah, so actually one of the women took me to B&H, the great photography place in New York City, and I bought a really good camera. And I said, it was like a formal decision, which was based on nothing. No idea of whether I really would be any good at it, but I'm going to be a very good photographer. And let's hope the gods are with me. And off I went and took a lot of really bad pictures. But then I started to get better. You know, I studied it, and I became friends with someone like Ralph Gibson, who was probably the world's greatest photographer. And, you know, I got mentored to a degree by him. But I was very passionate about it. And oddly, all those years with The Police, I photographed everything from the inside. That's where it started for me.
What a treasure that was. What a good idea.
Well, it's great. No one could get what I was getting. And I had a pretty zany idea of, you know, for instance, we'd do the show and all that, you know, blah, 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 and there'd be people there. But eventually you end up back in the hotel. Then I would start taking pictures, and I would invent all sorts of crazy ideas in the corridors of hotels and do things. I was looking for surrealism. So I'd be in all these kind of boring hotels, but I would try to make something out of it with a camera. Usually like strange events in corridors was my speciality.
Yes, and the ladies in there with the wacky things on them.
There were ladies involved. We should not pursue that line of thought because we might get banned.
I think you said it was powerful for you having that camera.
Well, you know, it's sort of amazing to me. And somebody raised this question in an interview this morning. When I got the camera and I started to really get into it, it's like the world woke up, or I woke up to a whole visual sense of the world, and I started to see everything. You know, I turned a switch in my head, and so I had a very different way of walking through the streets of New York or whatever, because I'm seeing angles, colors, shapes, lines, and, you know, in a way I didn't really before. because I started to go around with this sort of frame like this, you know, and it really brought that visual sense alive. You know, it's odd. I think I was so obsessed with music, but it, you know, sort of rode it over everything. But I think this was the emotional birth of it. When I was like 14, 15, 16, I went to a cinema in my hometown, which was called the Continental. And they showed the films of Truffaut, Fellini, Godard, Bergman, so on. And I featured this in the show because I like people like to know. So I was seeing all these very beautiful black and white art house movies. And that's, I think, where the seed came from. And when I got later on at this other time in New York, I think I was sort of recreating that emotion because I was shooting black and white. And so there is a sort of a background to this. Because I was very passionate about seeing all these films. I was a real cineast at teenage years. Yeah, I think that's where it came from.
You've had such an interesting career. You were given a guitar at the age of 6, was it?
No, not 6. 6, I was doing piano. I'd play piano from 6 to 11. And then I got given a guitar by an uncle, and it was a battered old guitar with one string missing. That's where it started, you see. And I absolutely fell in love with this little battered old thing, and I finally learned to tune it and managed to finally get the sixth string, and the sixth string was gone. It was all painful at the beginning, the first few chords, and off we went. But I was absolutely, at that age, had a passion for it and was obsessed with it. And, you know, that was my life. I knew that, this is what I am, a guitarist. By the time I was 12, I didn't go, man, I'm tired of that now, I want to do something else. That was it. And it absolutely defined me.
And then you were classically trained as well.
Yeah, I went to university in California eventually, and I played classical guitar only for about 6 years, and I was really deep in that repertoire. Yeah, because it was an extension of being seriously involved in music, you know, studying theory, you know, incredible harmonic stuff, and then, you know, using the classical guitar as well, you know. So the right hand is working very well, so I have those chops, as we call it.
There's something about the sound that you make on that guitar that is not, you know it immediately when you hear it.
Oh, that's very kind. Well, I think, you know, when I was a kid, you know, and I used to read Downbeat magazine, American magazine, I think, jazz. But, you know, one of the things that was always coming across to you was you must find your own voice. What's your voice? You know, what's your signature? You know, instead of being like a, you know, blatant copyist and just playing in style and not pushing out the boundaries of that, I always had this mantra in my head that you must find your own voice. Who are you when you play a solo? Why does it sound like you and not someone else? So, you know, you go through all these mental sets, trying to be a musician, trying to be a great improviser, being able to just like so familiar with the fretboard that you can play anything anywhere. Yeah, you know, so that was instilled in me before I was even, you know, 15 years old. So I listened to a lot of great musicians who had found their voice. In other words, you recognise that, you know, say it's Sonny Rollins playing the saxophone, you know that's him. Just by sort of that marvellous sense of humour he was actually able to even put into his saxophone playing. So, you know, you're sort of self-educating by listening and listening and going, I wonder if I could do that. You know, it's trying to get growth as a musician. You listen, you copy. Of course you copy, because that's how you're going to learn your instrument. How the hell did he do that thing? And you work at it, you I got it. Okay, so you do it there. Well, that means you could probably do it here, or you could do it here. And so you start to build this little repertoire of what early on we call licks. But you're building a vocabulary of being able to play your instrument.
Who were your influences growing up?
Well, you know, I mean, at that age, loved Wes Montgomery. He's a great American guitar, incredible, genius guitar player. I loved Jimmy Rainey, who was a very lyrical, marvelous improviser. I loved Kenny Burrell, dark and bluesy. I liked Grant Green. These are the ones I listened to. You know, I mean, everybody wanted to try and play like Wes Montgomery at that age. Well, if you were into jazz, I should say, you know, because his solos were very lyrical and very clever and beautiful, you know. So what you learn from that is how to play the guitar. If you can, you know, and this is the kid hunched over a record player, playing it at half speed. Oh, that's what it is. And you slowly work it out. And this is what I did. I'm playing a record at 16 and a third instead of 33 and a third, a black vinyl album. So instead of going, it's gone, and you slowly get it, you know,
oh,
and then you
smart.
Bring it up to speed. It's fun, but it's painful and it's slow. But, you know, it fully concentrates you on your instrument, in this case, the guitar, the neck of the guitar, and how to do it. Marvelous, you know. It's a kid learning and being obsessed. It's very healthy. Passion, you know, very interested in something.
What inspires you now?
Outside of, you know, any media, if somebody's really doing something that's fresh and you go, wow. I don't know if this applies, but we were traveling around on this tour and we're up in a place called Lexington in Massachusetts, I think. There's a great guitar store called the Guitar Emporium. And I walked in and, you know, because the guy who's working with me said, hey, you should check this place out. They've got some pretty unusual stuff. So I'm not a guy anymore who goes to guitar stores all the time. I mean, it's when you're younger, maybe. But I walked in. The guys were all great. And nice. You got Martin there. The usual, the Strats, the Gibsons. Then I saw this other little guitar. I said, what is that? I don't know what it was. It was shaped differently. It had a beautiful whammy bar with it, like a Bigsby, and coloured knobs, and the neck was short scale. And I picked it up, and it's bright yellow. Wow, this is special. You know, anyway, so you're asking what inspires you. I bought the guitar, and then I went back the next day and bought the other one, which is in surf green. So I've got two of these guitars. They're made by Andy Powers, and he runs Taylor Guitars. And so I've got two of them, and I got the yellow guitar, and I went straight on stage with it. Never done that in my life. I got this little yellow guitar, and I went straight in front of an audience with it, and I'm playing it. I'll play it tomorrow night too.
That's great.
That inspired me. Yeah. Yeah, who would have thought? A lot of feeling to it. I picked it up and played it a little bit in the hotel room this morning. Yep, it's there.
Fantastic. Yeah. How many guitars do you have?
Oh, I don't know, about 150, 200 or something. I don't know.
You keep them all?
Keep them. Well, certain auction houses trying to get me to sell them all at the moment. It's marvelous to have so many guitars. I get given a lot of guitars. I'm not actually me. I mean, there are guys, and isn't this an interesting point? Because the guys who really build big collections, they're not usually players. They're into all, it's a 58, but you see the way that, you know, it's another thing. I'm a musician, I'm a player. I don't really care too much about that. I'm not an obsessive collector. I have a lot of guitars because I've been doing it for a while, but it's been proposed that I could I don't really care about the money, but that I could sell them at a Christie's auction. I don't know.
How many solo albums do you have? Is it 14?
15.
15, okay.
Plus a lot of collaborations.
What's your creative process like, and how has it changed over the years, or has it changed at all over the years?
Well, I think it's all to a degree, it's all the same. It's really pathetic. I don't have any ideas. Well, you learn about this, you know, trying to write music. Where does it come from? You know, obviously you get educated and you realize, you understand there are structures. There are things that the song's going to need. And there are certain, obviously, you know, you can write a 32-bar song. It starts with these chords. And then in the middle, it goes to a bridge and it's got those chords. So, you know, dumb stuff like that, you know. I mean, for me, I'm trying to find something that's different, not just playing the standard straight-ahead style. So what it entails in reality, you know, for me, you know, I have a little other house at the end of my vast estate in Los Angeles. I call it the Casita, and I work in there. And I usually just play into like a Zoom recorder, and I notate the ideas. I mean, sometimes you're just sitting there, like in the dark, waiting for something to arrive. You know, you're fiddling about, and I'm heading towards something. Not sure where it sort of has to present itself. There's a sort of mystical element to this, where the music eventually will arrive. You know, the classic of that is you play through. Well, that's nothing, and then you go, all right, that's it for the day. I can't do anymore. And you play one thing. That's it. It arrived at the last minute. Composition, the idea that's something more original. So you have to trust the process. You have to have your fingers on the guitar neck. You're thinking and you go, no, that's a cliche, that's too obvious, that move, and blah blah blah. No, what if I play it up here and I put an open string in it? Oh, now it sounds exotic, it's sounding like something. So you become very intimate with all these moves you can make on the neck of the guitar. And I I have learned painfully, as I've done this for a number of years, to write it all down. You know, I come back, I go, okay, it's sort of in A minor, and I go, oh yeah, but you weren't playing it on in the obvious position. It's way up the neck, and the seventh is at the ninth fret on that G, and you're going to go on and off it to hit the A, and you're going to play the C on the... you know, so these are very guitaristic notes that I put down so that when I come back to this piece, and this is to all of them, I've got a clue, and I curse myself. I go back, and I go, oh, that's really cool. Oh, damn, I didn't say what it was. Because what I've learned, painfully, you know, I'm recording for 2 minutes, but at the end of the day, I say, okay, I'm playing in A minor. I've got the E on the 12th fret. The B string is open. I'm playing a C on the 4th string, and I haven't even got the tonic note in it. Okay, now I've got a clue. I got it. Okay, now I can proceed from there. So you work out these little processes to get you into composition. And I start in my little casita. Then I go to my real recording studio, big speakers, really clear sound. And I make a much better version of it. And then I'm preparing the path. And I could add on my own drums and bass if I want, or we bring people in, so on and so forth. So I'm very familiar with this process. And there's a certain amount of uncertainty in it, which is very good, because you don't set. Something suddenly springs out of nowhere. You go, oh, okay, thank you, Lord. That'll do. And then you put that in.
Amazing. So it's a process. It's intentional. You're in a string of bands, Eric Burdon and the Animals being one of them. It didn't last so long. And then the Police happened.
Well, the Lord was preparing me for the big band, you know. I mean, I'm a musician, and a lot of the time, for most musicians, probably 95%, we're all desperate for a gig, you know, like anything, you know. And I was able to play in most circumstances, and, you know, I started off being in a great rhythm and blues band in London that was very successful. So when I sort of went, okay, I'm going professional, and I moved to London with Zoot Money, we were successful very quickly. And so I only knew success. I never had really a down period, because I went to live in LA in California, and I wasn't in a band. I went to college instead. I sort of dropped out. I thought, well, I played in a band for almost 5 years with great success, and now I'm down and out in California, and I went to college, and I sort of got through that before I went back to England. And sort of resurrected again in London.
What did you study?
Classical music. When I went back to London, you know, I was pretty fully fledged as a player. And I had come back to the electric guitar, picked up my beautiful Telecaster in that period. You know, I was on the scene, and I was starting to get pretty well known. Quite well known as a pretty good player. He's being modest. And the odd thing is, it led to a band called The Police, which is in the so-called punk scene, where you weren't supposed to be able to play. So it was a path. It was an unusual path for me before we hit the rock solid.
But the train story. Tell us about the train story. For those who haven't seen the documentary or read your memoir, tell us about that.
You mean getting off the train?
Yeah.
Well, I was doing quite well. I was getting a lot of calls by that time in London. Everybody sort of wanted me to play with them. And there was this odd thing that happened. I played... There was an album called Tubular Bells in England, and it was number one for 2 years, made by a guy called Mike Oldfield. And it was very popular, obviously, for 2 years. And I was very involved with Virgin Records. Mike Oldfield did not want to play it anymore. And they turned to me and said, would you go and play it with the Newcastle Symphony Orchestra? I said, sure, I could use the gig. And it's like a sort of star turn. I was the guy with the whole orchestra. So great moment for me. The concert was divided into two sections. There was a band called Last Exit playing, and Sting was in that band. And I watched them for about 5 minutes, and then when I got a cup of tea or whatever I did, and I didn't really watch them. 2 months later, whatever it was, I was up there playing with another person, and, you know, another band I was in. And we all ended up in a hotel in Newcastle. And there was another band there called Curved Air, and they were playing. And so we ended up in a room together, hanging out, and I was lying on the floor with this lanky young American guy, talked a mile a minute. It was Stuart Copeland, and he told me all sorts of stuff where I could go and get something free. I always remember next situation was this other guy got me into the studio to do this one-off show in Paris, and it was, he was putting this band together, and he said, I've got these two guys, they've got a band called The Police, and it was, I didn't know, oh, whatever, you know. So I'm there, and Sting and Stewart were there, and this guy, Mike Howlett. So we started playing, and it was going quite well. So this is the first one. Then actually Sting came up to me, and he said, you know, I was in that thing when you did, you know, with the Newcastle Symphony. I was in the support group. I said, oh, yeah, man, nice to meet you. You know, yeah. And then the other guy, the drummer, came up, and he said, do you remember we were lying around on that floor together? So you think the Lord is at work here. This is kind of mystical. So we were sort of meant to be together, and there's more than one occasion of that. Anyway, I don't want to go on forever about that, but there was a sort of the beginning of the relationship. It sort of was a meant to be, you know, and that was it. But the odd thing was I was doing pretty well as a guitar player in England, and I joined this absolutely unknown so-called punk group and threw away all the steps I'd taken to sort of, you know, thank God, because I made a lot more money with The Police.
I think that all paid off.
Yeah, anyway, well, not to go on forever about this, but we did that whole thing. We played together in Paris, then I went back to what I was doing. But, you know, I think all three of us went, this was the band. And, you know, Sting and I got on the phone and we're going, yeah, man, you know, yeah, you should be in the band, right? You know, I said, yeah, but you've got another guy, Henry Padovani, who was more sort of, well, it's all pretend, like punk-like. He wasn't really a punk, he was a hippie, but he pretended to be a punk. And so we were having these sort of soulful conversations, but I wasn't in the band. Then I got on a train to go into central London, and I got out at Oxford Street, and as I got off the train, Stuart got off the train with me. He went, oh, God, what a coincidence. See, the Lord was at work. So we went, sat down and have a cup of coffee, and we went, yeah, you know. I said, no, I'm only one guitar, and you know who it is you're looking at. He said, well, that's difficult. I said, well, that's it. I would do it, but it's got to be me, you know. So that's where it was, you know, and not with any meanness of spirit at all, because I liked Henry, but there was a certain level, and, you know, Sting was, you know, reasonably educated as a musician. And so the two of us were very much coming from the same background, which was sort of jazz, blues, bossa nova, Brazilian music. You know, he was really into all that. And so when we got together and started sort of writing, that, you know, there was an amazing sort of mesh because of our backgrounds that we really, you know, it was magic.
Yeah, even that was different too. It was a trifecta. Three, you didn't see very, you know, three guys. That was rare too and different. And
the trio is really the strongest, the trio. And we also went, well, we're going to make more money if it's a trio. We don't want to add a fourth guy.
We, you know, thought of that.
Because we had nothing. Yeah. We had no money. We had nothing. We were absolutely down to, you know, living on the street at that point, which is great because, you know, you go from a situation like that and you gradually build it until, you know, the rest is history.
And then add Stewart.
Stewart
was
incredible. I mean, at that age, you know, a really sort of unique stylist, a great hi-hat player. I mean, you know, it was one of those, you know, once-in-a-lifetime things. You know, that's it. Yeah.
Awesome. When did you really know, wow, this is going to work?
I'll tell you when we really knew, because we were struggling, just desperate, you know. But our manager got us to New York City on Laker Airways, which was $60 return flight. Incredible. Like, so we could just about manage to get ourselves to New York, and we played at CBGB's. And it felt very good to us immediately, better than the UK, where we were sort of spat upon by the current scene. And CBGB's, they loved us. And we did this little tour up the East Coast here, and we went as far as up to Boston, I think, and we did some gigs in between. We played the Ratskeller in Boston, which was being very heavily promoted by the DJ in Boston called Oedipus, Round the Clock of Roxanne. And we sold out the Ratskeller for four nights in a row, and we were just thrilled to do that. That was sort of the marker. But then we went back to England, and there was nothing. So we thought, well, that's it. This is the end of the band. We're finished. And then the Lord struck again, and there's a band called the Albertos, and they were going to do it. They were quite big in England. They were going to do a 21-date tour. It started in the West Country of England at Bath University, so we could be on the bill with them for £50 a night. And so we, that saved us. That was a lot of money for us in those days. And so we went down to Bath University as the support group that was in this nice hall which held about 1,000 people. And so we're this humble little support group. Okay, we'll play first, then the big band comes on. But we went on stage and we were really hot because we'd just done 3 weeks in the States. So we were on fire. That's the way it was. And this hall was kind of filled with punks, 1,000 kids. Mobbing the stage, it was like a riot when we played. It was incredible. The Albertos were standing over on the side of the stage with very pale faces, like, we made a big mistake. Yeah, every night was a total riot for us. And that, after we did that first show with them, we went, we're going to make it. This is incredible. I went home and I slipped into bed with my wife at 2 a.m. in the morning. I said, you will not believe what just happened tonight. Incredible. Every night was like that. It was a riot. And from there on, off we went. We were the hottest band in the world, and they couldn't stop us.
And when did you know it wasn't going to work any longer?
Well, I don't think of it in terms of negatives. I think about the Police. It was so big. You know, people don't realize it now because it's just a while back, you know. But it was, we were like the Beatles. It was worldwide phenomenon. We only played stadiums, you know. It was incredible. We were playing to 50, 60, 70,000 people a night. Years at a stretch. It was kind of insane, but great. And we played very well right to the very end. You know, we were a great band musically. And I think, you know, one of the lead singers just decided that he had to go out on his own. That was it. Didn't want to be in a band anymore. And we were supposed to keep quiet about it because people were so, you know, like, oh, don't break out because there's so much money in this, you know. But we did. The weird thing about it is I think because we sort of broke up ahead of our time, didn't play for the next 30 years like some bands, it left a lot of like very, you know, people still want it, you know. It left a lot of power in the music that we had done, yeah.
Synchronicity, 40 years, right?
Anniversary. Well, it's coming out now, the new, well, and apparently it's looking very strong.
It's going to be special editions and...
Yeah, all that, yeah.
All that jazz.
Yeah, I mean, somebody asked me, well, what did you decide about? I said, I didn't do anything. Yeah. The record company did it, and they tell us. I go, all right, great, if that's what you want to do. Right. I'm not sitting around all hunched up going, can we put it out, and what are the tracks? And you know, I'm not even... okay, great, put it out.
That was not one of your favorites, right?
I think the second album was... For me, you know, because we really sort of got our style, and I think it really came together on the second album, which was made in 10 days. And we were, you know, we were playing all the time, so we were kind of on fire. You know, we were really a unit, playing unit. So for me, the second album was where it still hadn't gotten too sophisticated. I mean, Synchronicity is more polished and we're kind of studio pros now, you know, whereas the second album I felt like, it's still got that rawness and that freshness.
What are some of your favorites to play live? Because you still play them, so.
Message in a Bottle always, of course, stands at the top of the whole lot. That was a great piece of songwriting from Sting. And that's the one I think people really respond to. It's a very original piece. I love that. In my show, I play, you know, because I have to play some of it. I can't not play it. I did it for a while. I would play Message in a Bottle as a solo guitar piece, which... I'm good enough to be able to pull that off, excuse me. But I play that in the show, Bring On The Night, Roxanne. I've got a really great version of Roxanne. Certain songs, I always like Bring On The Night. I thought that was a really great song, you know. I don't dislike anything we did. I'm honest.
It was all amazing. All amazing. Yeah. Do you still communicate with the guys?
Not a lot. I mean, we are in communication, basically because... We have a very heavy past. You know, we're talking about business and finances and all that stuff and record releases. So it's more related to that, not like, hey, man, what are you doing today? You know, we're not like that at all. We had a very intense relationship that went on for about 8 years. And so we move on. You know, of course, we're always going to be attached. We're never going to ever be able to get away from it. And I don't particularly want to, but it is where it is. And there's all sorts of concerns. I mean, here comes this new album. What are we going to make? Who's paying us? Blah, 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 blah. It's a whole other conversation, which is not that interesting to me. I pay attention and I'm pretty smart about it, but we have pretty heavy legal people on that all the time.
People think there's like a rift between you and Sting.
No. I could get up and call him right now. Not going to.
Do you think there'll ever be a reunion someday?
I don't think so, because we've done it. You go, well, I'll never do that again, never do that again. I mean, it was fantastically successful. Name another old band that can sell out stadiums all over the world. We could do that again. I don't think it's going to happen, but I never say never. You know, I just say, the door's open. Call my people. That's where I'm at with it. You know, I have another band in Brazil, and it's called Call the Police. It sort of came about gradually because I play in Brazil a lot. And I go down, I'm this great singer, bass player from a famous band, Rodrigo Santos. So we were doing a bit of a mix at the beginning. We did a few shows. And the guy that we work with, who I've worked with for years in Brazil, said, I think we'll get another drummer. We had a great drummer, but we needed the power of a famous drummer. So we got the drummer from the Paralamas, and that kind of powered the whole thing up. So it's like an all-star band now. And so we sort of, not drifted, but we went, it's all Police. We just play all Police hits. It sells out everywhere. I'm going back next month for 4 to 5 weeks all over South America, and it will be a great laugh, great fun.
You spent some time with John Belushi. I have to ask you about that. What was he like? Because not a lot of people have spent time with John Belushi.
That's a great guy. Very funny, you know, fun to be with. And as you would imagine, you know, his sort of professional presentation, that's who he was. You know, he was a fun guy, you know. We were very simpatico. In fact, it's a little bit sad, actually, because, you know, we died at a young age. I was going to do a movie with him. I had this, you know, it's a very bizarre thing. I went back to England, knew John, and I was spending a lot of time in the US. He gave me a script to read that we would do. I was reading the script one night, and I was looking at it, and the phone rang, and it was someone who worked with the Police, Kim Turner, and he said, oh, I've got really bad news for you. I said, oh, what? He said, Belushi died. And I had the script in my hand, and so it was so sad, you know, because I was here in New York with him. I was in Indonesia with him. I was in LA with him. And we were having a kind of fun hookup, you know. It was great. It was one of those things.
Any guitarists of today you particularly like?
Well, there are several great American guitarists, you know, obviously like John Scofield, Bill Frisell. The one that's good, in my opinion, pretty youthful, is Julian Lage. He's more of a jazz guitarist, but he's very talented, and I think a fresh, interesting voice on the guitar scene. So he's the only one I would name at the moment.
What would your current self say to your younger self?
Actually, don't worry, it's all going to work out. Just keep your head down over the guitar, because I went through some pretty lean times when I lived in California, went to college and all that. You know, I had no money. The only thing I believed in was practicing. Keep practicing. Not like a goal, like one day you're going to make it, you're going to be anything. You know, I just wanted to be very good, very, very good. And I practiced 10 hours a day to try and achieve that, you know, and then ended up in a punk band where I didn't need any of that information, which is ridiculous. So I you know, not to be corny, but I absolutely believe in, you know, doing that, keeping some sort of a goal in your mind and practicing and never letting go of it.
Would you have changed anything during the time going through everything you went through? Would you have done anything differently?
Not really, no. No, I enjoyed all of it, you know.
What does music do for people?
Great music elevates the soul, and, you know, all art aspires to the condition of music. Music is our highest form of expression. Since the caveman first struck the wall of the cave with a piece of wood, and then he let out a yell, that's where music started. And it led to Andy Summers.
What's something you always bring with you when you travel?
Well, guitar, obviously, you know. My Kindle, which I read, because I'm an avid reader. I never stop reading. Yeah, you know, those are the comforts. Obviously, I have to have a guitar with me always, because I have to, you know, it is physical. So I don't, you know, if I've got a gig on Wednesday, I start playing on Monday, and so got to keep the hands moving. My hands are in great shape. They didn't get arthritis, they didn't get anything. I'm pretty loose, which I'm very pleased about because I know other guys, they got problems. The little sort of soul comforting things, you know.
What's your favorite comfort food?
I'm not a total foodie, but I'm pretty into it. My wife is an incredible cook, and well, we're very parallel in most things, but probably Italian food.
All right, good answer. Yeah, your marriage, a true love story, second time around.
Yeah. I think I'm incredibly lucky. I met the love of my life when I was still in my early 20s, and we've been together all our lives. I'm a lucky man. This doesn't happen for most people. We're so as one, you know, right, you know, very, very good. I've had a very good life. You know, I had some down moments, but not that bad because I always had the guitar. So even when I was scraping the barrel in terms of finances and, you know, living off nothing, I had the guitar. And that, you know, I never lost my belief. And it came in a strange way, ultimately, you know, to hit the bigger things that you'd want to get to. Well, I never lost my belief in where I was down. I kept the faith.
What's your favorite way to relax when you're not working?
Well, it could be watching a Bogart movie or something like that. You know, I don't know. I like to read. You know, I like playing the guitar, actually. I'm very happy to go, let's play for a couple of hours. You know, there's something around it is discipline, but I also actually just enjoy it and working things out, writing music. I never think of it as work. I've never thought of it as work. I thought, this is who I am, it's what I do, and I love it. That's it. You know, it sounds simplistic, say, well, I'm just a guitarist. No, you're playing music. It's intellectual, it's physical, it's an expression. It's a great thing, you know. It's not, you know, being in some stupid rock band and just like, you know, trying to get girls and take drugs. There's more to it than that.
Well, it shows clearly, you know, it makes all the difference.
Best. Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. To see more of this interview, visit our website, lifeminute.tv. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Life Minute TV.